So please re-welcome Perry Marshall.
Yes, sir.
Hi. You brought up supplemental sources around the New Testament, so you're opened up for this question, okay?
Uh-huh.
A learned Unitarian friend of mine said, discussing the New Testament, and let's leave out the book of Luke for purposes, that Jesus spoke in Aramaic, but the New Testament that we have is in Greek. And a couple of the disciples, one was a fisherman, probably spoke Aramaic. How did the Bible get the Greek? And another one was a tax collector, etc. So does this lead us to think that the book of Matthew was really written by the Matthew community under Matthew's direction, and the book of Mark was written by the Mark community under Mark's direction, and by that, someone who knew classical Greek was able to take the verbal descriptions and put it into the Bible?
Well, there's two parts to that question. First of all, is there anybody here that knows all of the fine points of the Greek and Aramaic question? Do you? If you come to the microphone and address that specifically. Meanwhile, I want to make a comment to part of your question.
Now, what are you asking specifically?
Well, about what was written in Aramaic and what was written in Greek.
Actually, I came up here. I'm selling Amway. actually, my response was going to be that the New Testament was actually written in what's called Koine Greek. I think you mentioned classic Greek. So I don't know if I'm sitting in front of there.
No, you're not still. No, I'm going to go in another direction. So go ahead.
Yeah, and as far as the Aramaic versus the Greek and what Jesus spoke, not super familiar with that. Sorry, but the Koine Greek was the common language of the people. So what you had in the New Testament was it was written in the common language of the people, the street language. Not sure why you were leaving Luke out. So. But I just wanted to clarify.
Luke was known to be educated in New Greek, so there's no question there that he could write Greek. But when you have a fisherman, can the fisherman write Greek? That's the question.
Right. Well, that and Greek was a common language because Alexander the Great had spread the Greek culture and Greek language throughout the region. So it wasn't that they just suddenly decided to write it in Greek. It was a fairly common language. So anyway, I just wanted to.
If you read what early church fathers wrote about those books, what you learn is that the book of Mark comes from Mark following Peter around for a number of years and writing a history which, according to some of the church fathers, was personally authorized and checked by Peter. And they also tend to say that Luke is derived from Mary's telling of the events. Now, I think one thing that comes up in this question is, well, two things. First of all, a lot of people are skeptical of oral traditions and oral cultures because, the Gospels were written somewhere between 60 and 90 AD, most scholars agree. They go, well, that was 30 years later, and this all would have got changed around, and all the stories would have been changed. You have to remember something about pre-literate cultures, which is if you can't read or write, you have to have a good memory of what you've been told. Now, we don't have to, like, I don't even try to remember stuff anymore because I'll just Google it, right? And we are very sloppy about you know, what somebody said to us and how they said to it. But if all your business contracts and all your transactions and everything was verbal, you would get really good at remembering exactly what people said. And so if you go look at ancient cultures, you see that they're very good at remembering things. Now, the second thing is, there is a book, and I can't remember the name of the author off the top of my head, but he's the pilot of the Enola Gay, which was the bomber that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Okay? And he tells this whole story. And the book was written in 1998, and he died a couple years later. Okay? Now, so you got, you know, the bomb was dropped in what, 1945 or something? And then, you know, 50 plus years later, he writes a story. Okay? Now, first question is, does anybody seriously doubt that he remembers what happened? Not really. He was a young man when he dropped the bomb. He's an old man when he wrote the book. Nobody's really going to seriously question that he's telling what really happened.
Because the big parts.
Well, yeah, especially the big stuff. And because, look, there's people alive, people that were there, and all that, right? Now, at the beginning of the book, he explains why he wrote the book. Why did he write the book? He says, I wrote this book because there's all kinds of revisionist history going around. People saying stuff like we really shouldn't have bombed the Japanese. They were very nice people. We should have negotiated with them. There would have been a better way. We did all this harm to all these people in Hiroshima, and we shouldn't have done this. And his purpose in writing the book was saying, no, they were totally unstoppable. They killed 20 million people in World War II quietly while we were paying attention to the Germans. They wreaked havoc all across Asia, and they were going to come after us too, and this was the only way to stop them, and it was the kindest thing we could have done. Okay, now, I'm not trying to get into a debate about just war or something, but what I'm saying is, at the end of his life, he said, I got to set the record straight. I got to tell him what really happened. And it's fascinating, you know, flying the plane, dropping the bomb, going into a 135-degree bank, the brilliant flash of light, the shaking of the airplane with the shockwave. It's a fascinating book. But he had to set the record straight. So finally, before he died, he did it. I would submit to you that what you see in the Gospels is not all that much different. These guys were perfectly capable of remembering what happened. And I would even go a step further and say that what happened to the Council of Nicaea in 325 was a little bit like that too. All the church fathers from the different churches in the Middle East got together, they converged, and they said, you know what, there's all kinds of rumors flying around, and we're going to draft this statement, and the vote was 314-2. Okay? And the two that disagreed, they did not disagree that Jesus was the Son of God. They just disagreed about what exactly it meant, or, you know, some stuff like that. And so I think this comparison to the guy that wrote the Hiroshima book is very comparable. So and there's a whole trail of evidence surrounding early Christianity, and, you know, every 20 years you go forward, there's more and more and more documents, and they all tell a pretty coherent story. Paul.
Since the previous person who used this mic decided he wouldn't really put a shameful plug to sell something, I'm going to do something that might seem a little bit akin to that. If you are interested in reading some more of the writings of the so-called early church fathers, they actually are quite available. I'm told it's not the best translation, but Christian Book Distributors will sell you literally a 30-volume set. It's about that big because I actually ordered it once. Got it.
Wow.
About $300, I think it is, and you can see what Polycarp wrote or somebody else. You know, it's there. There's more stuff that never got, maybe at least 1,000 translated, but the time wasn't included, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's not at all complete, but, you know, it's, you know, probably $10 a volume. I suppose that's pretty reasonable.
Now, along that same line, I've got a book that's kind of similar, but it's one book instead of 30, you know, in case anybody's interested in that approach. It's called Faith of the Early Fathers by Juergens, and it's eye-opening. I mean, this has letters written to churches in like 70 to 80 AD, 85, 110, 120, 150, and there's actually a second volume and a third volume too. And if you put all three together, you've got major church father writings all the way into, I don't know, 300, 400, 500 AD or something like that. But like the first volume, I mean, if you've ever felt like, well, gee, you know, is there anything outside the New Testament? Is it, do we just have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and that's it or what? You face the early fathers, and it's you get a distinct flavor for what early Christianity is like, and frankly, it's not much different than modern Christianity today. Really fascinating. And another one, in case you know you guys are interested in, like, you know, okay, what about stuff totally outside of the New Testament that talks about Jesus and secular historians? There's a book by Van Voorst called Jesus Outside of the New Testament. And in exhaustive detail, he talks about other documents from ancient historians, you know, Josephus and all these guys, and some that most people have never heard of, where that reference Jesus, and he talks about him. And it's a very fairly written book. It's not like a trying to bang you over the head with his point of view.
And
so,
if you wonder why you can't buy those in our own seats, I inquired about that when the Da Vinci Code was going around, and why is there not more stuff about church history? It's because none of us buy it there. So
right.
If you'd like to see some more of that stuff, go and ask and request it, and maybe they'll start carrying it.
Yeah, or you get it on Amazon. So, yes?
You were talking about the influence of the printing press.
Yes.
And I was thinking, so how do you compare that to the web today? And also, I was thinking, even with a printing press, whoever owns the press is controlling a certain amount. And the web today, you know, big search engines or smaller people who do email advertising and stuff have such great influence too. Yet it's kind of the same situation as the printing press is, and what is Christianity's how is that affected by the web?
Well, I think that's a great question. Let's go back to, you know, the old days, old days when if you wanted to write something, you had to write it on a scroll, okay? And you had to do it by hand, and nobody knew any different. You know, if something was going to get written down, it had to be pretty important, okay? Now, compare that to, you know, somebody's blog where they say, my menstrual period started today, and, you know... You know, this kind of stuff, right? Like people put, you know, their whole life details, and sometimes like the most irrelevant stuff, or they don't. I mean, you pick any topic, and the web is full of garbage, right? I mean, silly opinions, stuff that's not researched, hearsay. I mean, how many of you got the email sometime in the last month? Still getting the email that says, if you forward this to 256 friends, Microsoft will send you, you know, $5 for every one of them or something, right? I mean, that's still going around, you know. So in some ways, the web has made lies able to travel faster than ever before. Well, so between then and now, you sort of have a progression, and it's not all good. Okay, I think there's some goodness to the fact that, you know, we don't have a huge number of documents from the ancient world, but the ones we do have were considered, like, pretty important. So it seems to me that, first of all, the greatest need for modern people is discernment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's never been in demand like it is right now. If you want to know what's going on and you're surfing the web and you're going to the library and reading books, there is so much information out there. You have to be very discerning of figuring out what's accurate and what's not. You really have to do your homework. This, go ahead. Yeah?
You know, when I go on the web, I have a tendency to believe everything I read and then later on find out the opposite. It's like I make that first call and then I...
Right. Right. Well, it's... The expedience of it encourages that. You know, it's like, hey, you want a fast answer, but there's no editors. How does Google work? Google works on popularity, not editors. Okay, so if something's popular, may be true, may not be true, but if it's popular, a lot of people like to go to that website, a lot of people link to that website, then it turns up number one. Well, you know, that creates a whole environment for what people consider to be true, which is not necessarily what is true. I think, you know, the message for Christians is, you know, if you know this stuff, then you need to get on the web and you need to publish it. And if you don't know something, then you should keep your mouth shut. That's kind of my opinion. Is that helpful?
Yes.
Yeah. You would turn the microphone down.
I'm concerned about the world today, and there are a lot of politicians and very rich, important people who claim to be such very good Christians, and they're destroying this country. And I'm wondering if you, as Christian people in this church, are aware of the lies that some of them are spouting and the way they are destroying the working people of this country. And are you marching? Are you saying anything against Mobil Exxon, against all these CEOs making all these hundreds of millions of dollars and firing all the good working, hard working, good people of this country? Are your churches speaking out against things like that? Because they profess to be such very good Christian politicians, and they're fooling a lot of people. And this is what I see around me. I'm old enough to understand this. Since the Vietnam War, since Kennedy, Martin Luther King, all these assassinations, I'm not that stupid. I put two and two together. And I'm wondering if people are awakened. Are they thinking for themselves? Or just being led down this path?
Well, you know, sometimes thinking for yourself is might have a lot to do with figuring out what news sources to read and what to ignore. I mean, I kept thinking as you were saying this, yep, there's like nothing new under the sun. You know, politicians were corrupt then, politicians are corrupt now. I mean, When Pilate crucified Jesus, what was that? That was a complete inversion of the justice system. And then what's he going to do, wash his hands of it? Okay? I mean, he's like any politician, pretending to be innocent, pronouncing himself innocent, all the while shedding innocent blood. Okay? And, you know, I don't think the answer is in politics, but I will say this. You know, remember what I said about look, if you can read it, it's available to you, then you're responsible and accountable for it, right? Well, think about this. You know, before there was such a thing as democracy, who was accountable before God for what the government did? The king. And his advisors, they were accountable. Were the peasants accountable for what the king did? I don't think so. How about in a democracy? Well, if there's 300 million people in America and we all get to vote, who's responsible for what politicians we have? Us. If we got corrupt politicians, it's our fault. And we're accountable before God if we don't get rid of them. So, it's on our shoulders.
What about when it's a limited pool of candidates?
Can you go to the microphone?
I'm sorry. What if it's a limited pool of candidates?
What if it's a limited pool of candidates? Then, pool, well, somebody's got to stand up and run for office. I don't know that it's going to be the most pleasant thing. And different people have different ways of attacking the world's problems. I'm not a very political person. I'm not very involved in the political process. I'm rather cynical about it. My take is, if I teach people about Jesus, it fixes the culture from the ground up. And I'm not personally involved in a whole lot of political stuff. I have other friends very involved in trying to correct political problems, and I applaud them for it. And I think, every single one of us has a limited amount of time, resources, money, everything. We can only focus on so many things, but we all got to do what we know how to do. We all need to address injustice in some way, shape, or form, and not sit and drink our Budweiser and eat our bag of Ruffles and watch Monday Night TV all night. And, if good people are being responsible, then bad politicians will tend to recede. That's my take. Yes, sir.
Hi, Terry. Thanks for your good presentation tonight. And
thank
also
you
for being vulnerable in this last slide and showing that. And what it showed me is there's heart behind the process of what you showed tonight. Can you talk to that a little bit in terms of, because my experience is that's part of the journey of coming to grips with these lies type thing and myths. And it's just not a thinking process. There's also a heart piece to it. Could you add that element?
Boy, what a great question. I'm not sure where to start, but I guess where I'll start is, Laura and I having this thing of trying to go to visit poor people, to visit poor countries, and do stuff like that. And a long time ago, when we were having a lot of financial struggles and everything, we kind of made a commitment to each other: if we ever got to a point where we could afford to do things like that, that we would, and that. We wouldn't just take the Disney vacation, but that we'd also, go see how the other half lives. And the first time I ever did that, I went to Sao Paulo, Brazil in 1999. Well, Sao Paulo is a city that's one-third the size of the Chicago metro area with three times as many people, or something like that. I might not be remembering that quite right. But there's 17 million people in Sao Paulo. 500 million street kids that sniff glue and steal for a living. Every now and then the street kids get out of hand and the policemen go out and shoot them. I was walking by an Alpha Graphics copy shop in downtown Sao Paulo, and across the street there was a homeless boy laying in a doorway sleeping with his dog. It's like, whoa. And I tell you what, when you go see places like that and you come home, you don't go, my latte is too foamy. I came home from that trip. I never liked Bill Clinton, just, for what it's worth. I was like, Bill Clinton is a great president. And we have no environmental problems. We have no poor people. This is a great country. That's how I felt after spending a week in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And we had a guy take us to the favelas, the slums. We spent a day touring the slums with a guy who, I trusted him to know how to make sure we didn't get shot. And I think that there's always a part in the Christian life where you have to be pushing the edges of your comfort zones. It's one of our obligations. If you're comfortable, If you're like too comfortable, you're not pushing yourself. Now, I don't know this for a fact. It's just my little theory. But my little sort of theory that I have is if you push your comfort zones and you go into uncomfortable places and you stretch your envelope, maybe God doesn't have to. You get lazy, you get complacent. Sometimes God's got to throw you a curveball and wake us up. Because we all have this lazy streak that just wants to, you know, lay in the couch. And, you know, look, there's too many problems in the world. You know, and going to places like Africa, look, if the people of the world had the will to solve these problems, they would be solved so fast. You can't blame God for the fact that Africa's a mess. You know why Africa's a mess? Because they got corrupt leaders. You know where all that foreign aid goes? It goes into Swiss bank accounts. That's where it goes. You know what happens when they drop food out of airplanes? People with machine guns surround the food and sell it to poor people for a lot of money. You can't solve Africa's problems dropping food out of airplanes, and you can't solve it by sending aid. Big epiphany was when I was in Mozambique watching these wonderful people minister to these poor people in Africa with all these problems. It's like Africa's problems is not going to get solved by anybody dropping anything out of the sky. They only get solved when people roll up their sleeves and go there and live. You know, and everybody's got to go somewhere and live with the problems and try to solve the problems. And when we do that, the church becomes credible.
Thanks, Barry.